Okay, dear comrades, thank you for inviting me, a representative of the Union of Communists of Ukraine, to your Congress. It's a special honor of us, Ukrainian communists and former Soviet communists, to be present here in the land which produced outstanding Marxist thinkers, Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, and consistent communists, fighters known and honored all over the world, such as Rose Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, okay, Ernst Thälmann, Bertolt Brecht, and thousands of others. We take them as our close friends and predecessors, because being internationalists, we appreciate everyone who share communist ideas and is ready to fight for them. Maybe I will take a couple of minutes to present our organization, because actually it's for the first time that we are present at such an important meeting with such a great number of card-carrying members. So the Union of Communists of Ukraine was the first communist organization in Ukraine, which emerged as an officially registered party after the ban of the Communist Party of Ukraine in 1991. So within 2 years, within 3 years, we managed to get registered. And our members, we are working all over Ukraine, in the vast majority of the regions. Actually, in 16 regions out of the 22 regional areas of Ukraine. Some of them, we are former members of the CPSU. Some of them were just initiative communists, what we called them, like people who shared communist ideas but never joined the corrupted bureaucratic CPSU. At the very beginning, we emerged as an organization aimed at some practical achievements within workers' collectives. We approached workers' collectives at industrial factories, at small enterprises, wherever we could reach them, propagating, giving lectures, arranging discussions, and disseminating communist press from all over the former Soviet Union, from Russia, Kazakh Republic, Armenia, and some others. So at the very beginning, we named ourselves and we acted as internationalists, though nationalistic wave started to get rise in Ukraine at that period. When the ban was canceled and the Communist Party of Ukraine once again showed up in the political scene, they started criticizing us for being non-professional politicians, for no-name people, and our criticism was directed against their desire and practice of just parliamentary work, taking part in elections, the strive of getting places in the parliament and collaborating with bourgeois governments of Ukraine and presidential administrations. That's why between the so-called official party, like we call it, official Communist Party of Ukraine, a member of the parliament, and us, the Union of Communists of Ukraine, was a great difference. And this difference has been only broadened through all the period of coexistence. Of course, in comparison with the Communist Party of Ukraine, we are a small group of people. At the beginning, we were only 2,000 members, but if you remember the period, of course, you do not remember, but some of you maybe remember the period of the early 90s. You should understand what meant to be a communist, to expose it publicly, to campaign publicly. Sometimes we were beaten by nationalists, sometimes we were attacked by police, but and to mobilize 200-300 members in one city was a great deal of work, especially when we managed to recruit some workers or low-rank engineers from industrial enterprises to us. So such is our prehistory, and let's speak about the present day. I haven't prepared our contribution in terms of thorough academic analysis. It's rather a propaganda text where we expose our position on the events which are taking place on the territory of Ukraine, because we call this war the war on the territory of Ukraine. I will explain why. It's a plain, it's really a simple, plain text in order to explain our position very clearly, to avoid some interpretations or doublespeak. So the present day situation cannot be understood without referring to not so long history, back to the late 80s, the so-called perestroika, when suddenly our motherland, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, started dying out. We couldn't understand the attitude of the Soviet peoples of different nationalities, that they allow this process to deepen. Even before getting registered at the party, we, on individual basis, unofficial basis, entered the so-called communist initiative. If you know the story, Communist Initiative was a kind of a platform within the CPSU. A number of representatives, in future, Nina Andreeva's party, if you know this name, you know, of course, the Broad People's Movement, anti-capitalist movement headed by Ampilov, at the then time, very revolutionary Russian Workers' Communist Party and the Union of Communists of Ukraine gathered in Moscow to stop Gorbachev's perestroika. So then the dialogue and common actions were organized and resulted in forming a number of communist organizations in a number of Soviet republics. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, they managed to get registered. Such was the Union of Communists of Georgia, the New Communist Party in Moldova, and many, many others. Yes, these were not numerous groups, but usually these organizations had a very Marxist, knowledgeable core of people, not obligatory academic scientists, not obligatory intelligentsia, but those people who were interested in Marxism and its practical implementation. That's why I'm very proud of those times. I'm proud not of myself, I'm proud of Soviet people who produced such strata of communists who didn't betray, who were ready to sacrifice, who were ready to work, forgetting about themselves, to work to promote communism and to stop bourgeois tendencies in the society. So that's why we refer to Soviet history with all possible criticism, but with sincere feeling that it was the best representation of the international communist action. I mean, the construction of the Soviet society with special social relations, with special air of brotherhood, solidarity, and sincerity, which was the case in the 20s, 30s, after the Great Patriotic War, I mean, the Second World War, like we call it, yes? Great Patriotic War. And even in the late periods of this damned perestroika, there was a lot of sincere communists who did a great job, but unfortunately failed, because the society itself started decreasing in terms of communist senses and feelings, started getting closer and closer to consumption society on its small level, but nevertheless it was completely alien to what has been constructed before. With all the difficulties and contradictions, now I go by the text, okay? With all the difficulties and contradictions that accompanied the building of a socialist society in the USSR, the bulwark of the world communist movement, the bulwark of defense of the world proletariat and national liberation movements fell down when this country collapsed. On the ruins of the Soviet Union, the unthinkable under-socialism processes of criminal robbery of the vast majority of population, its impoverishment, the processes for complete degradation of public morality, the growth of nationalism and chauvinism arising of the armed ethnic conflicts that led to hundreds of thousands of victims among earlier fraternal peoples took place. The Baltic countries, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Moldova, Chechnya, Nagorno-Karabakh, North Ossetia, Abkhazia, this is not a complete list of hotspots or beds of war of the cooling star of the Soviet Union. The integration of the economies of the two most economically developed republics of the USSR, and from that time the so-called independent Russian Federation and Ukraine, was so close under the Soviet Union, all encompassing over 90%, that both of these countries could become involved in conflict relations only with some delay. Gradually, little by little, through voucherization, privatization, through a system of criminal agreements with foreign partners, through deindustrialization. Both of these republics, which once made a huge contribution to the establishment of the Soviet power, laid the foundation of the Soviet economy and created a huge production potential as a guarantor of the strengthening of socialism in the USSR, both ensured victory over Nazi Germany in the most terrible war of the 20th century, World War II. And after turning to bourgeois rails, Russia and Ukraine, inevitably, I would call it Russian Federation. Don't call it Russia, it's Russian Federation, because Soviet Russia was also Russia, you see? Now it is Russian Federation. And so when they turned to bourgeois rails, Russia and Ukraine inevitably took the path of fierce competition in the division of the Soviet heritage and tug of war on themselves. At the same time, both newly proclaimed capitalist states were thoroughly permeated with corruption, which paradoxically, for more than a quarter of a century, till early year 2000, was a certain stabilizing factor in relations between the two countries, allowing their ruling elites at the very least to agree on shares in finishing off the remnants of the common socialist pie. First of all, this can be expressed in pumping out minerals, the use of Soviet infrastructure, including the gas pipeline, chemical and metallurgical industries, scientific developments, and technologies. The statistics of the period from the mid-90s to the first decade of our century testified to the intensification of mutual investment activities on the territory of Ukraine, the participation of Ukrainian capital primarily in the development of the fuel and energy complex of Russia, and Russian capital mostly in the agricultural, agro-industrial, machine-building, metallurgical and chemical complexes of Ukraine. For example, in the year 2010, the share of Russian capital in Ukrainian enterprises was 20%. One-fifth, can you imagine? As of the year 2020, about 7,000 companies with Russian beneficiaries remained in Ukraine, and it is after Maidan, this fascist coup d'etat of 2014. But they remained as business actors in Ukraine, while more than 600 Ukrainian commercial companies operated in Russian Federation, mostly in construction, logistics, real estate, and other sectors. The national bourgeoisie of each of these countries became more active in suppressing and oisting a foreign competitor from its market, especially since, in the case of Ukraine, these tendencies received significant, they started to have financial support from international monopolies and geopolitical competitors of Russia, the United States, and its satellites on different continents. Only over the past 8 years, Ukraine has received $50 billion of loans from them. I mean commercial loans, before the war emerged, you see. $50 billion of dollars, which made at that time more than half annual budget of Ukraine. These processes in which economic interests, driving forces and their motives, internal and external factors of influence are so intricately intertwined are often seen on the surface in their transformed forms in a field of specific political actions, thus ruling analysis with insight into the essence, thus requiring, the analysis into the essence of those processes. This is all is still more necessary today when the world is on the brink of the Third World War, and the most urgent task is the correct theoretical substantiation of the tactics and strategies of the world communist movement. So now we are surviving through a very difficult period. Imperialism is once again showing its predatory face, organizing and inspiring wars all over the world. We remember that since the year 2000, more than 49 wars were unleashed. Speaking about wide-scale conflicts and small, allegedly ethnic conflicts are not included on that list. I'm not going to enumerate them all, you know perfectly well. By the way, I had a lot of discussion, not only me, but my comrades. When I say I, I mean the Union of Communists of Ukraine, So the members of the Union of Communists of Ukraine had a lot of discussions with our international friendly parties, and with our international opponents, members of the so-called peace platform. You all heard about that, right? I hope. And reading the same text written by Lenin on imperialism, we understand it differently. It was very strange for me because Lenin's texts are so clear. They do not need any personal opinion, actually, but just deepening of its understanding on the matter, on the facts of the present day developments. For example, some of the opponents, even in France, even in Great Britain, do not understand imperialism like a special stage, the last stage of the development of bourgeois society, of capitalism. They understand imperialism in Kautsky's way, in Kautsky's mode, as foreign policy of the countries. Those people who pretend to be Marxists read in our presence, read up those texts, and once again insisted that imperialism is policy. Some comrades who I knew personally for long and who are very knowledgeable in terms of reading Marxist texts and Lenin's texts, insisted that the theory of imperialism needs some reforming today because the balance of political forces has been changed. As if there is any difference who is on the top of this imperialist pyramid, the United States or any other actor. The name doesn't mean the essence. What is important is the essence. For proletariat, there is no difference what is the name of this imperialist crocodile who is suppressing them. But many comrades fail to understand it, unfortunately. We understand imperialism, as you can guess, in Lenin's terms, of course, as a not as a qualitatively new formation, but we understand it in terms of those special characteristics which Lenin gave to imperialism. First of all, this is the power of financial capital, the red division of the world, etc., etc. You know that perfectly well. The nature of the development under imperialism is uneven. Therefore, in clarifying the essence of imperialism, it is not important what place each individual country occupies in this hierarchy, but what characteristic features the imperialist system as a whole has. Moreover, one of the signs of imperialism, Lenin calls the completed territorial division of the land by the largest capitalist countries. And he names them precisely capitalist, not imperialist. It's understandable why, because the character is capitalist. At the new stage, when a system, international system, has been formed, it's imperialism, but it's capitalist in its nature, with some new features. Capitalism is such a historical, social historical formation that, being at the imperialist stage of development for the first time in history, covers the whole world, all countries simultaneously. And being in the state of imperialism acts as a general trend in the development of bourgeois society as a whole. Sorry for repeating that. It drives me to some conclusion. Maybe I shouldn't argue it in this audience, but this is a continuous debate with our opponents, even within the Solid Net network. Okay, I'll admit that. Therefore, when disputes among communists arise about which capitalist country should be called imperialistic, which should not be, we consider such a formulation of the issue to be fundamentally wrong. Such attempts to name something by using the terms from the lexicon of Marxism-Leninism, instead of exploring the concept of imperialism, not as a word, but as a concept, that is, without separation from the subject of the study, from what it means, is nothing but nominalism. That's what we are sure in. In the era of imperialism, it is not so important whether the capitalist country is an established, full-fledged imperialist. It is important that any aggressive expansionist action, both within the country and in the foreign policy, will be imperialist in its nature and be a manifestation of imperialist policy, because it is included in the world system of imperialism. And therefore, it means, if necessary, building up one's territories by both direct seizure of someone else's territory, or indirectly by acquiring new markets, expanding the sphere of influence of one monopolist by the others, etc., etc. This is what is happening today with the Russian Federation, and not only, as with the bourgeois state. This is what really drives the policy of its ruling circles in the current situation. The same motives drive all the new states of the United West in the alleged Russian-Ukrainian war. Of course, the fact that the materialized logic of the development of capitalism is such does not relieve specific politicians from the individual responsibility for their actions. But understanding this can help remove rose-colored glasses in a failed attempt to determine which of the bourgeois government is our, which one is alien, who we are to support, who we shouldn't support, let it put it like that. So in our opinion, it makes no sense to concentrate on trying to find out whether the Russian Federation is an imperialist state and whether, for example, France or China are not. After all, in spite of everything, in the era of imperialism, the ultimate beneficiaries of any war will be the formalized non-territorial class of the bourgeoisie, the financial oligarchy. And this moment brings us to the second topic, which is now being talked about more and more. We have to touch upon the concept of the so-called proxy wars. The war on Ukrainian territory has all the markers of such a war. Nevertheless, which imperialist parties in this war on the territory of Ukraine issued a power of attorney to the Russian Federation to conduct it, and which ones to Ukraine? Today, after nearly 22 months from the beginning of this war, we already see those who have received and continue receiving their dividends. These, of course, are not the peoples of the Russian Federation and Ukraine, and in general, not even their governments. On the other hand, the United States has significantly strengthened its position in the international market for the sale and supply of raw materials, crushing the EU fuel market and eating up a part of its machine building. In turn, China has dramatically increased, and is increasing the supply of raw materials from Russia at a reduced price. A reasonable question arises. Didn't we by chance list those who issued the power of attorney to wage this war? Today, in any conflict of any nature, be it economic, ethnic, religious, or civil, we will find economic reasons, and each side will always defend the interests of one of the major imperialist powers. The only way to find the culprits, quoting Lenin, is to ask the question, who benefits? If in February 2022 it was too early to say with absolute certainty that the bloodshed in Ukraine is a proxy war between the United States and China, today it has become obvious. Those countries which block with them. Both Russia and Ukraine, as nations, are nothing else than instruments in their hands. Now I have to touch upon the slogan of anti-fascism in a pro-fascist reality. We are well aware that the only real antagonist of Nazi Germany was the USSR, precisely because it was a socialist and therefore a proletarian state. The great patriotic war, and we call this period of the Second World War on the territory of the USSR, Great Patriotic War, was a class war, despite the fact that thousands of workers died on the part of the fascist coalition, as well as the fact that part of the Allied forces were represented by bourgeois state. It was really a class clash. As it was mentioned above, to determine the nature of war in the era of imperialism doesn't matter whether this particular war is waged by ripe imperialist countries or not. In any conflict, be it whatever nature it is, each side will always defend the interests of one of the major of an external imperialist powers. I'm repeating myself. Fascism as an instrument of the dictatorship of finance capital differs from democracy only in that way that it is an open terroristic dictatorship. The bourgeois dictatorship in the form of democracy, parliamentarism, is replaced by a terrorist dictatorship at the moment when the living space of one or another financial monopoly is at stake. In this sense, US anti-fascism in the World War II was not in its essence a real anti-fascist policy, because the goal of the United States was not to defeat fascism as a phenomenon, but to defeat German Nazism as a regime of the imperialist state that is a competitor, a strong competitor. Therefore, when in the publications of various communist organizations, primarily Russian, British, and European, it is proposed to support the Russian bourgeois government in its alert struggle against fascism, we see a slogan about, we see the, how say, traces of the slogan about supporting the Russian Tsarist government in the spirit of 1914. But by no means it resembles the Soviet slogan about the fight against fascism of the 1941 model. Exploiting Soviet symbolism, waving red banners, is nothing but bourgeois simulacra. To be anti-fascist is to be anti-capitalist, which by definition a bourgeois state cannot be. Despite the fact that the Russian Federation deftly manipulates anti-fascist rhetoric at the level of public conscience of the part of its population and the population of other post-Soviet countries not nostalgic for socialism. As long as the labor movement is poorly or weakly organized and is in decline, all the proletarians and other unprotected, underprivileged sections of population will suffer from the consequences of war. Whatever its results, none of the representatives of the bourgeois elites will suffer real losses. Whatever the outcome of the war, ordinary families around the world will suffer from it. They will die physically or like the inhabitants of Ukraine, or suffer from sanctions and possible reparations as in Russian Federation, and also lose their lives at front, or people can feel decrease in the level of life due to the rise in the cost of utilities like it is in the EU countries, etc. The communists who proceed from the interests of the workers have nothing to share in this war. Just as the workers for whom bourgeois states are not their fatherland. Actually speaking, maybe it's a little bit sensitive, nostalgic, but you know, many of our members feel themselves as people without motherland after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I don't take Ukraine as a motherland. It's a part of my ethnic and cultural surrounding, but not my fatherland, if you can understand what do I mean, for which it is necessary to live and to die. And any truly socialist country will become, at least in my feeling, my motherland. And this is a very strong feeling. This is internationalism, not only spoken, but felt deeply in your heart. So, in the communist movement, unfortunately, there is still no unity in the assessment of the ongoing war. From the beginning, we share the position declared in the joint statement No to the Imperialist War in Ukraine, signed by 42 communist parties and 30 communist youth organizations on SolidNet. The trouble is that many parties seek to support one or another conflicting side in the imperialist war, although it is necessary to fight against capitalism as such. Opinions vary. Actually, there are three, four blocks, depending on classification, on this matter. From total accusation of the Russian Federation of an aggressive policy and accordingly support to Ukraine, like, for example, PTB, Workers' Party of Belgium, or the Red Party in Norway, the parliamentary Red Party in Norway. They supported the war on the side of Ukraine, officially from the parliamentary tribune, signing a declaration together with the bourgeois members of the parliament. The mistake of those comrades who pretend to be Marxists is based on their thinking in terms of the superstructure only, and not the entire socio-economic formation. Such comrades proceed from the understanding of imperialism, once again, as of politics. Is it time? Okay, so you understand what I'm inclining at, right? Okay, so that is the first position. The second position is siding with the Russian Federation, and there you will find a lot of absolutely crazy point of views when you can read in some documents which are officially announced that the Red Army which is coming to Ukraine. This was written by Clara Dzhebekova, the leader of the Communist Party of Kyrgyzstan. By the way, Clara Dzhebekova is a senior doctor in philosophy. So such are strong sentiments and nostalgia of the Soviet Union, see? That which is drives this opinion, because she's a very sincere, very good comrade, but completely unable to think philosophically, as though she is a philosopher by herself. The third position is, it seems to me, conscious support of their governments, both in Ukraine and in Russia. Unfortunately, many our former comrades, the comrades which were a part of us, and we were a part of them, because from the very beginning, the Union of Communists of Ukraine joined the Russian Workers' Communist Party, thus stressing our internationalism and joint work. We were a part, as an organization, we were a part of the Russian Workers' Communist Party. You see? Not because we are pro-Russian, because we are pro-communist. And the Russian Workers' Communist Party, quite unexpectedly, shocking to us, sided with its government. They find all possible pretexts to prove their position, and it seems to me to assure themselves that they are right. Because, of course, they understand they are not right. The pretext is the slogan of anti-fascism, which they see, which they heard in Putin's speech, but they didn't hear his aim to decommunize Ukraine. You see? Very strange. And there are a lot of such parties, you know, maybe the majority of them, etc. It's very often that they manipulate with terms the major evil, the United States of America, and the less evil, less developed Russia, which can ensure a milder regime, and workers will not suffer that much as they are suffering now under fascist Ukrainian regime. It's funny enough, let's take Donbass, what the campaign of the so-called support of Donbass people brought to Donbass. I will tell you, I'm finishing. So first it was an eight-year period of hypocritical promises to support and unsuccessful bargaining with the world partners, like Russian government called Western partners, after which Russian protégés emasculated the pro-Soviet essence of the uprising in Donbass, establishing, in fact, military dictatorship in Donetsk and Lugansk. So the results of this fighting against fascism in defense of Donbass is done with the spontaneous people's uprising, extermination of the dozens of field commanders who showed themselves just from the ground, who were not even military by their professions. Okay, and but of course, privatization of industrial enterprises, no political freedoms, etc., etc. The only one privilege that Donbass people acquired is that this dominance, that this so-called liberation, counter-liberation, is done in the Russian language. So, to finish that all, I would say once again, it is important to be internationally united, to organize a common campaign. Let's take an example of Cuba. It seems to me it is very efficient when each month on the 17th date, people all over the world gather to protest against sanctions. And in some period it was the slogan Free Cuban Five, etc., etc. I mean that without joint international action, what we are talking here will remain words. Thank you ever so much. Proletarian all over the world, unite! Thank you.